Okay, Sean and Bosai, thank you. I just want to introduce somebody who's very much part of YU, but most of you don't know him yet. Our Rabbi Dr. Eddie Reichman, who's the Musmuch of our yeshiva, went to the yeshiva here, was Musmuch of the yeshiva, and then went on to medical school. He's an emergency room physician at Montefiore,
correct,
up in the Bronx, and is very, very involved in anything Jewish medical ethics anywhere in North America. So he's the advisor for the YU Medical Ethics Society and everything else, and involves a lot of medical ethics around the country. And every year he gives a shiur to us, every year it's a different topic, so this year it's brain death, so hope you enjoy. And Rabbi Reichman is very generous in terms of making himself available for the smicha students if they have shilas and want to discuss questions, either practical or not so practical, you know, even years after the shiur. So it's good to, he often, he might share with us his email address and contact information, so it's a good reference to have for later. So thank you, Dr. Reichman.
Great. Thank you very much, Rabbi Orlin. The pleasure is chus. Always great to spend time with the smicha students, as Rabbi Orlin said. Very important. We're going to discuss one topic. Baruch Hashem, in the age that we live in, the scientific explosion, the medical advances have been so extraordinary that you really need at least a full year course just in medical halacha alone. Even that probably wouldn't be sufficient. So it's nice that you get a taste of the beginning of life you had from Rabbi Brander, the fertility issues and the bris from Rabbi Tendler, and the tzitzis of the pe. Now we're going to shift a little bit to the end of life, but there is much, much more than could be covered in this course. Some of it's covered in your later years, but as Rabbi Orlin said, it's an open invitation for any of you who have any questions about any issues related to medicine and halacha. I need to give a shiur on the topic of medicine, halacha, need makaros. Don't hesitate to email me. I think I have my email on the end of the presentation, and I'm happy, as always, to email the presentation. I'll give it to Rabbi Orlin for you guys to have for access. I also give permission, if you use the PowerPoint at any stage, to just block that out. I don't have a problem with that. You can use anything you want. Lahagdil Torah, lahadira. So we are going to talk about a very complex topic, a topic which is engaged poskim not just in the 20th century and 21st century, as we will see, but in previous generations as well. And our objective today is to cover four sections. Section number one is descriptions of death in Tanakh. Number two, historical precedent for the present brain death debate. Three, the medical diagnosis of brain death. And four, the halachic analysis of brain death. Now, before I continue, has anybody here heard any previous discussions or done any reading in this particular topic of the definition of death? I have a handful of you. Okay, great. There will be some medical things here that we discuss. Whatever we discuss, this is an informal discussion, not just a frontal presentation. If you have any clarifications, any shilas, don't hesitate to interrupt in the middle, and we can, if you have the question, likely someone else does, and we can clarify. We're going to begin with the descriptions of death in Tanakh. Now, in addressing any halachic topic, you always start with the Chumash and then move on forward to the Gemara and Rishonim and Nachronim and etc. While there are, of course, many people who die in Tanakh, there is no discussion about what defines death in Tanakh. There are a few discussions or cases, as we will see in a moment, of interesting halachic issues related to somebody who's actually dying or potentially dying, and those we will focus on in the hopes of finding something which will help us in our journey about the definition of death in halacha. And one of those actually is here in the story of Yaakov in Sefer Bereishis. And I will mention this really to begin with a somewhat historical context, which you'll see as we proceed through the lecture will resurface as we discuss the contemporary issue of the definition of death. And that is a story which you're all familiar with, but I suspect you are not familiar with the pshat of the Ramban on this story. And that's the story of Yaakov, when Yaakov finds out that Yosef, his son, is actually still alive. So it says, Vayalu mi Mitzrayim, Vayavo Eretz Kanaan, El Yaakov, Avihem, Vayagidu lo lemor, Od Yosef, Chai, V'chihu Moshel b'chal eretz Mitzrayim. And this is the phrase we're going to focus on for a brief discussion of this. And that discussion, that the phrase is Vayafog libo Hiloha emin lahem. Does anyone want to hazard a guess what the word Vayafog libo is? Or what its chorish is?
It's an interesting. I happen to remember there's a machlokas Rashi Ungulus, but I'm trying to remember now which one. The word pog. I mean, it's the question is what that word means exactly, right?
Right. Interesting.
Pog, like by the Mishnah, you have underdeveloped the fruit.
So it's interesting that, and the truth is, I never really thought of this till you mentioned that. But pag in contemporary Hebrew is the word for a neonate, for an early developed born child. So a child born before term, preterm child is actually called a pag. And I actually never made the association here with Bayofag, but obviously there is an association. The answer is it's impossible to translate. No one really has a clear translation. You'll see in a moment what the Ramban says, but it's not an easily translatable word. So Vayafog libo, something happened to his heart. Ki lo ha'amin lahem, because he didn't believe it. Vayidavroi lov is kol divrei Yosef, asher diber elayem. And you all know the story about the agolos, which asher sholach Yosef. Of course, there's a difficulty, because it seems that Paro actually sent the agolos, not Yosef, but maybe through the advice of Yosef, whatever. Then, after this, vatechi ruach Yaakov avihem. The ruach of Yaakov was restored, became alive again. Now you're all familiar with Rashi, who brings the Medrash Vatchirach Yaakov, that Yaakov had lost his nevuah and his nevuah was restored at that point. So that's the classic interpretation. The Ramban, however, gives a physiological interpretation, not a drashic interpretation, which reflects on our discussion about the definition of death and the physiology of the heart and the physiology of the lungs. Just a brief parenthesis. You are all familiar that the Rambam was a physician. And in fact, the Rambam, in addition to his extraordinary contribution to the world of halacha, which I obviously don't need to share with you, made a significant contribution to the world of medicine as well, contemporaneous medicine. He wrote many works in Arabic in medicine. He wrote on asthma. He wrote a treatise on hemorrhoids. He wrote a treatise on how to lead your life in a healthy fashion. These works are still available. They have been translated into Hebrew. They've been translated into English. You can actually find them in your local bookstore. As a matter of fact, there are people today that are looking to the works of the Rambam in hopes of extracting kernels for how to lead your life today. It's an interesting approach. I'm not sure how valuable it can be, but people have definitely been able to identify things of import. The rough contemporary of the Rambam was the Ramban. What you may not realize is that the Ramban, according to accounts, was actually a physician as well. We know very much about the Rambam's practice of medicine, both from his medical works and his own letters about his own practice. We know very, very little, precious little, about the practice of the Ramban. According to some, he trained or was practicing in the south of France. How do we know that the Ramban is a physician? We know from two or three sources. We know from his Talmud, the Rashba. The Rashba has a tshuva about the permissibility of using a medallion of a lion, which was an astrological figure, and whether it was mutter to do because of Darkei Amori, Avodah Zarah. And he says, I know that it's mutter because my Rebbe, the Ramban, used it when he treated people who had kidney disease. And there's another account, I think it's in the Vedic Abayis, if I recall correctly, of the Ramban treating a non-Jewish woman for infertility. And the question was, you're not allowed to assist an akum to be molid, a child who's going to be an Oved Avodah Zarah. So how did the Ramban do this? So there's different interpretations. Some say he did it because he was receiving compensation, which was a heter. It's another interesting discussion about whether physicians in general can receive compensation from a halachic perspective. But be that as it may, the purpose of this parenthesis is to share with you that the Ramban was also a physician. So when he's writing this out of medical, first-hand medical knowledge of the medicine of his time. And he writes, V'ganzeh v'yafag libo sh'nizbateh libo paskonishi maso. So what is v'yafag libo? Nizbateh libo, his heart stopped, u paskonishi maso, and his breathing ceased. So basically, he had what sounds like potentially a cardiac arrest, or at bare minimum, he fainted. His heart stopped, and it was as if he was dead. This is a known entity. And when someone gets a surprise, v'huzkar v'sifrei refuos, and it is mentioned in sifrei refuos, and again, the Ramban was a physician, so he knew the sifrei refuos firsthand, ki lo yisbelu zeh hazdekeinim v'chalushi hakoach, that elderly people can't tolerate this kind of sudden surprise. And obviously, Yaakov finding out that his son Yosef was alive, Yaakov an elder man at this stage, and this is literally the surprise of his life, she's alfu rabbi mehem. Many of them will faint. Litaleif is to faint. Bevolahem simcha befet pitom. And this is the thing I want you to focus on. Ki yeh halev nirchav niftach pitom. Why? What's the physiology? The heart expands suddenly and widens and opens. Vehachom hatoladi yotzei umitpazer bechitzonei haguf vayefas halev v'hiskararo. Now, if you would read this in your parsha, you would look at this and you would have no idea what this is talking about. My objective is to enlighten you about the physiology of the time that the Ramban was writing. And if you went to medical school in the 12th century, this is what you would have learned. And this is how they understood cardiac and respiratory physiology. So one of the things that they have to account for was the following. In this room, the temperature is roughly about 68, 70 degrees. The temperature of all of our bodies is roughly around 98.6 degrees. Now, they knew that there was a temperature differential between the environment and the individual since the times of antiquity. We now, today, understand the reason for this differential and how it's possible for our bodies to have temperatures above the temperature of our environment. We know that there are chemical reactions, including ATP, which generate heat, which generate energy, which allow our bodies to maintain a certain temperature above the environment or below the environment, as it were. They didn't understand this in the times of antiquity, so they postulated the following. They said, how is it possible that the body is hotter than the environment? So they did an analogy to a furnace or a fireplace. So when you have a house, how do you heat the house? You heat the house through a central fireplace. And that fireplace causes heat to be conveyed throughout the entire house. How do you keep those flames going? You use a bellows. Bellows is comprised of air. And you have to keep that air going to keep the flames going. If you breathe too much air, if you push the bellows too hard, fire is going to blow out. If the bellows doesn't go fast enough, then the heat can overcome the house. And this is how they explain temperatures above normal or fevers. And it was all, in English, it's called the theory of innate heat. In Hebrew, it's called Hachom HaToladi. And this is exactly what the Ramban was referring to. Hachom HaToladi Yotzei Mitpazer. What happened? The Hachom HaToladi dissipates and goes external to the body. And as a result, the heart cools down and the body either dies or faints. This was his physiological interpretation. And he said, so what happened? So they mitched him, they pushed him, they nudged him a little bit, and they told him about the agalos. Then, oz shebaruchu alav, the chazro neshima sovachaya, a physiological concrete explanation, his breath returned to him and he became alive again. V'zehu v'tachirach Yaakov avihim. This is what it means that v'tchirach Yaakov avihim. Not that the Medrash says, which is not pshat in the pasuk, that his nevuah came back, but literally he started breathing again. His breath, his ruach, his spirit returned to him. He was successfully resuscitated. This is what the Ramban says. Other resuscitation episodes in Tanakh, and there are a few interesting episodes which you may be familiar with. One of them is a haftorah. The haftorah you're probably more familiar with than the others. This is the case of Eliyahu's resuscitation of the Ben HaTzarfatit. I'm not going to give you the context around this in the interest of time. But Eliyahu was told about this son and this child who became very ill. Ad asher lo nosrabo neshama. Until he had lost his neshama. And neshama, and this is an important thing in your reading of pre-modern sources, neshama is colloquially used as your soul. But neshama is also etymologically related to neshima, which means your breath. And in modern Hebrew, to breathe is linshom. So neshima means a breath, not just soul. Now obviously the two are kabbalistically and spiritually and physically related. You know, as the Kadosh Baruch Hu breathed in the spirit of our soul through the breath, as we'll see in the Gemara in Yom in a few minutes. So what did Eliyahu do? And this is a fascinating sugya for another time. Vayismodeid al hayeled shalosh peomim. He prostrated himself upon the child. Vayikra al Hashem vayomer Hashem elokai elokai teishivna nefesh hayeled hazeh al kirbo. Restore this child. So the child's life was restored, and what appears to be a successful resuscitation. And those who are historians of medicine and are trying to find precedent for what we now know today as CPR or cardiopulmonary resuscitation actually look to these episodes in Tanakh as early accounts of what CPR would have been. Of course, from our perspective, these are not physiological resuscitations. These are miraculous resuscitations done by Derech Neis. Although, as we will see in a moment, there are different approaches how Nisim occur, and many Nisim take place with at least a Shemetz, with at least an aspect of being B'derech HaTeva. So there may have been actually an allusion to what ultimately would be CPR at that time. How do the Rishonim, who are Meforshei HaTorah at that time, interpret this? This is the Radak and the Ralbag, just an example or two. Efshar gamken ki osa kein lahanshim alav ulechamamo b'chom hativi. Why did he have to prostrate himself on the child? So again, this term comes up again, chom hativi, and you will now understand this next time you see this in the Perush on Chumash, or next time you see this in any other sources. So the Ralbag says, Ralbag also in the Middle Ages writing, maybe he did this to breathe into him and to heat him up, to warm him with the chom hativi, with the innate heat, hayotze mipano v'mibsaro, which is emitted from his body. Ki rov tamim hanisim na'asim ayde ma'atach bulo miderech ha'olam. So he's trying to give a physiological explanation to what was ultimately a nace. Again, These are resuscitations. Just for your interest, and I'm not going to dwell on this, but I leave it in the slides, which I will send to you, Mirtz Hashem. There's a fascinating Shaila of the Radbaz, based on the following. There is a Shita that Eliyahu is an incarnation of Pinchas. Pinchas was a Kohen. So the Shaila of the Radbaz is Sha'altami Meni, L'man damar Pinchas ze Eliyahu heich nitmo l'hachayos ben hatzarfatit. So if indeed Eliyahu was an incarnation of Pinchas and he was a Kohen and the child had already died, then how is it possible for Eliyahu to intervene and attempt resuscitation? After all, he'd be Mitami Lameis. And the Radbaz has a number of interesting answers. Amongst them, there's a Havamina that this child, the Ben Tzarfatit, was a goy, was an akum, and that's why it said Vayis Modeid al Hayeled, because there's a shita and it's machlokas aposki, but there's a shita that goyim are not matami tumas ohel, so he literally suspended himself over the body but didn't actually touch the body directly, and he said he has a whole host of other answers. It's a very fascinating discussion about this answer. It's an answer of Tosos, I believe. Hatosos tirtzu v'perikam akabel shahaya borur lo shiyichayehu. That it was clear and definitive and certain that Eliyahu would be able to successfully resuscitate him. Therefore, it was mutter mipnei pikuach nefesh. So there's an interesting discussion about what the makor is for pikuach nefesh in the Gemara Yom on Shabbos, whether the makor is the chai bohem, or whether the makor is chalalav shabbos achashem and yishmor shabbos is harbe. And for those of you who are at all familiar with the sugya, the nafkamin is in terms of whether you know for certain you're going to be able to succeed in the resuscitation or not. So this might reflect on that whole halachic discussion, and therefore since he knew he was going to succeed, that's why he was able to do it. So those are interesting pre-modern discussions about resuscitation. Now this is the chapter I was referring to, which is an antecedent to the contemporary discussion of the definition of death, and it dates back to the 1700s and 1800s. And it really began with the following, and we'll see how it entered into the halachic literature. Back in the 1700s, this fellow, Jacques Binion Winslow, wrote a book in Latin, which was titled Morte Incerte Signa, which means the uncertainty of the signs of death. And that in that book he wrote, death is certain, since it is inevitable, but also uncertain, since its diagnosis is sometimes fallible. And the argument that this book made, and is a very comprehensive, very well-researched argument, is that today, in 1740, doctors don't have a complete grasp on the diagnosis of death, and it is quite possible that they will misdiagnose you, and you will be buried 6 feet underground while you are still alive. Now, had this book remained in Latin, I suspect it wouldn't have had much impact on the world, although Latin was the lingua franca in the 17th and 18th century. But as the history would have it, it was translated into a dozen different languages and literally disseminated across the globe. And it created a tremendous fear, literally, across the entire Western world, that if you were alive at that period of time, your doctors might misdiagnose you as being dead and you might actually be buried alive. For those of you familiar with Edgar Allan Poe, there's a famous short story called Telltale Heart. There's a few others in the literature of that time, all reflective of this pervasive belief that, that you could potentially be buried alive. And there are those who capitalized on this, entrepreneurs, and created these kinds of device. This actually is from the U.S. Patent Office, but there are many, many similar ones. And what they did is they created these kinds of contraptions where you could be buried underground, but you'd be hooked up to a pulley system which is connected to your toes and to your nose, and then goes up to a bell tower on the top of the grave. So if you woke up underground, it would ring a bell, hence the term saved by the bell. So that is actually, according to many, the true origin, not the boxing origin, saved by the bell, or the schoolhouse saved by the bell, whichever you prefer. But this, many say, is the origin of saved by the bell. Now, of course, someone had to actually be in the cemetery in order to know that that it was ringing. So as a result of the dissemination of this belief, it ended up that many, many countries decided to adjust their burial practices accordingly and even make legislation about burial practices as a result. For our halachic purposes, the most famous one is the Duke of Mecklenburg in 1772. Duke of Mecklenburg required all those who were diagnosed as dead in his geographical domain to be kept above ground for 3 days until putrefaction begins. Putrefaction is when the body starts to decompose. This presented serious halachic problems. We all know Kavur Tikvarenu Bayom Hahu. You can't wait 3 days. It's an Isser of Halonas Ameis, potentially Isser of Nivul Ameis. So this generated a major worldwide halachic discussion about the propriety of this new law. Does it in fact jive with the halacha in terms of suffix, maybe that the person's alive? Or is it neged halacha, and we have a chiyuv to try and bury somebody despite the fact that the law says we should delay burial? Every major posek of that generation weighed in on this halachic discussion. It was one of the most historically significant, for sure, in the world of medical halacha, but in the history of halacha in general. By the way, an interesting historical tangent, the person who came to the Duke of Mecklenburg and told him that the Jews are burying too fast and maybe be, quote, killing people as a result of their early burial practices was a man by the name of Olaf Tixon, or Titian, depending on the different pronunciations, who was a professor and Orientalist in Germany, who was one of the only people in history ever to receive smicha, who was a goy. He was a brilliant, brilliant man. And actually, he was involved with a medical school and university in Germany, and he had from medical students who were his students who wrote papers on Jewish topics with him. This is in the 1700s. But Olaf Tiksen is the person responsible for sort of ratting out the Jewish community. Even though he dealt with the Jews and wrote in Hebrew better than any of us could write in Hebrew, he also had this undercurrent of being a missionary as well. So the two of the more famous people were involved in this three-day burial debate, which in essence was the precursor to the contemporary discussion, because now you have a major debate in the halachic world about how death is defined. That basically, in essence, was the issue. So up until the 1700s, there was no havamina for anybody to question the definition of death. And how do you think someone would have been diagnosed as being dead in the 1400s or 1500s? Put yourself back a few hundred years. Well, how would you diagnose somebody as being dead?
Stop breathing,
heart stopping. How do you determine that the person stopped breathing?
Take a feather and you put it next to his nose.
Take a feather, right? Put it next to his nose. Now, what if it happens to be a windy day? Could have a false, so we call false positive. They'd put a mirror to see if and you do that today. You see, if you put a mirror. Nobody has mirrors in their tefillin anymore. Everyone's using their iPhones. But if you take a mirror, put it next to your nose on a cold day, you'll see the respirations. Heartbeat. They did assess for heartbeat. Exactly when taking the pulse became part of the practice of medicine, it was not part of the practice of medicine in antiquity. Taking the pulse became part of the practice of medicine many, many centuries later. But they did obviously know there was a heartbeat. Where is the easiest place to feel for a heartbeat? You can feel it on the chest. Is one of the places you can feel it, and we'll see what the Gemara says in just a few moments. So the people that were involved in this halachic debate, they turned initially to Rav Yaakov Emden, who was one of the towering poskim of that generation. And Rav Yaakov Emden and Moses Mendelssohn, the reason why Moses Mendelssohn was involved, because Moses Mendelssohn was much more articulate in the language of the time, and also much more capable of interacting with the authorities in an effective manner. So he was also involved in this discussion. And in fact, Rav Yaakov Emden paskened that you should not delay the burial, and we'll see other poskim in a few moments. And even though the authorities say you wait 3 days to ensure that the person is dead, he said you do not wait the 3 days, and they basically tried to get a religious exemption. Now, you're familiar with this today, the concept of religious exemption. For autopsies, for example, Jews try and get religious exemptions. Interesting, a brief halachic tangent. So, for example, in California, they just instituted a law that it's now possible for the coroner to not require a physical autopsy, but to permit what's called a vertopsy, which is a virtual autopsy. In certain cases, specifically in cases in the frum community. And a vertopsy, in essence, is an MRI image of the body head to toe. I don't have those images here, unfortunately, in this slide presentation, but you can Google it easily. Just Google vertopsy. Images are spectacular, and you can manipulate them in any way, shape, 3D form you want, and you can see, you know, every organ of the body from head to toe, like you're literally looking inside the body. And they've been doing studies over the last decade or so comparing a classic autopsy, which is clearly, from our perspective, a major nivul ames, to a vertopsy to see if you can accomplish the same objective. And they found that in most cases, it's relatively close. And if you need to do a guided biopsy of certain organs based on the vertopsy, that would be much less halachically objectionable. It's interesting that even though Moses Mendelssohn went to the authorities and on behalf of the Jews requested, oh, by the way, the other religious exemption, which probably merits another full discussion at another time, and I really think it's essential, is vaccination. So I don't know how many of you are up on the major vaccination debates that are going on today in the 21st century. But unfortunately, there are many, many people within our community who are not taking advantage of vaccinations. And there have been a number of outbreaks across the country. And unfortunately, a number of those outbreaks of measles, of whooping cough, have been specifically identified within the frum communities. So it's a major, major issue. And people, in, especially those of you who become involved in school education, there will invariably be people who request religious exemption for vaccination. And there's the halacha question is it permitted to request a religious exemption as a frum Jew? Is it permitted for a school to prevent a student from entering who has not vaccinated, if it's a frum institution? So these are issues for another discussion. And a fascinating one as well. Very also important halachic halachic analysis. Sorry about that. Okay. What's interesting though is that while Moses Mendelssohn himself went to the authorities and went to the Duke of Mecklenburg to try and intercede on behalf of the Jewish community, in his own personal writings, he actually advocated for the delay of burial. And his logic was as follows, and it's not such crazy logic. He said, what's the reason why we're delaying burial for 3 days? We're not delaying because of Nivul HaMeis. We're delaying out of Safek Pikuach Nefesh. The purpose of the delay was that the people might actually still be alive. So why shouldn't you wait for 3 days? And he brought a raya from Masechta Smachos, which says in Perek Ches Halach Aleph, Yotzin l'beis hakvaros upokdin kol meisim ad shloshim yom. You go to the Beis HaKvaros and you visit the Meisim for 30 days. The Ein Choshishim Mishum Darkei Amori. Don't think it's like necromancy and it's some Isser of Darkei Amori or Isser of Avodah Zarah. Why not? And he says, Umase Shepoktu Echad Achar Shloshim Yom. So there's one case where someone was found who was believed to be dead. And on the 30th day, they came to do their rounds to see, just to confirm that the patient was actually dead. And in fact, the patient was not dead. V'choya esrim v'chamei shonim v'achar kach meis. And lived, this person lived another 25 years, and he had had a number of children afterwards. So Moses Mendelssohn brought this as a riot, and maybe you should wait. That was his havmina. By the way, Pokdinim al Mason, obviously these people weren't buried underground. They were buried underground. Pokdinim al Mason is going to be irrelevant. You're not going to see if they're conscious or unconscious. This refers to these above ground burial sites, which you may be familiar with. Those of you that have visited Eretz Yisrael, you'll see and you'll wonder when you go to these places like Kever Melachim and all these other places where they have these kuchin or these coves or above ground burial sites, and you'll wonder what exactly are these above ground burial sites? So the truth is that these above ground burial sites were really temporary burial places. And you may have also seen or heard, for those of you who follow biblical archaeology and peripherally, they find occasionally these, the name just skips my mind for a moment, these bone boxes, these small coffins, looks like a small coffin. It's not a sarcophagus. It'll come to me in a moment. They found these small coffins from antiquity, and they weren't sure exactly what they were, but it turns out that they were bone boxes, if you will, that the bones of the Meisim were put in these boxes for many times for transport or for burial. And why was that necessarily the case? Because in those days, if someone died hundreds of miles from their original homeland, from their original cemetery, to transport the body today, you just put the body on a plane. And you're there within a few hours' time. But if you're transporting a body on a wagon over a few weeks' time, the body's going to decompose, and it's prohibitive. You basically can't do that. So what they would do is they would do, I'll take your question in a second, what they would do is they would do a temporary burial until the body decomposed. And once the body decomposed, they do what's called likud atzamos. That's what likud atzamos means. If you look in Shulchan Aruch, you guys didn't do Avelis, you do Avelis in the third or fourth year probably. So you have to do a day of Avelus for Likud Atzamos. So when they transfer the Atzamos after the body desiccated, after the body decomposed, and they transfer the Atzamos to the family burial plot, so then you'd have to sit a day of Shiva for Likud Atzamos. Yes? Asuari, yes, that's it. That's an Asuari. So there actually was a debate whether they found an Asuari that had the name of what they believe is the brother of Yashka. I don't know if you guys heard about this. So it's a debate whether it's actually a forgery or it's the real thing. So that's a fascinating debate about forgeries in general in biblical archaeology. And this is also reflected in this book of a contemporary physician whose name was Hertz, and Marcus Hertz wrote an entire treatise actually advocating. So he was a physician, and he was a sort of a liberal, a masculine physician, and he, like Mendelssohn, was advocating for the delay of burial because of Suffolk Pikuach Nefesh. And on the very cover of his book, you see a man standing over a tombstone, and the tombstone is of Moshe Midesau, which is Moses Mendelssohn. And you see, I don't know if you can see clearly, you see right behind him, unbeknownst to him, is a man sort of coming up from the grave, meaning that, you know, someone who's probably been buried who is still alive. So you can see where his allegiances lie, and that he obviously supported that. So in that particular chapter, the physicians, and we'll contrast it to the contemporary discussion today of brain death, the physicians of that time believed in the delay of burial and not immediate burial, because they thought from a medical perspective it may indeed be a suffix based on the medical literature of that time. It may have actually been a suffix if the patients were still alive. The question also came to the Chasam Sofer. We're going to mention it now. We're going to mention it a little later when we talk more about the halachic sources that of the contemporary debate. So in the Tshuvas of the Chasam Sofer, the following shaila came to him. And it's interesting. Shalom v'chol tuv, harav charetz ha'muflag zayis ra'anan yifei pri toar, kara shmo kavod moreno harav ploni, av bezin v'rosh m'sivta tekilas ploni. So if, I'm not an expert in the tshuvas of Chasam Sofer, but the people who write about this tshuva say that the Chasam Sofer usually names the individual who is writing him and to whom he is responding. In this particular case, he specifically left out the name because he was so upset by the shaila and thought it was like such a offensive shaila that he didn't want to be malshin the person who wrote the shaila, so he left it out. We know that the person who wrote the shaila to him was the Maritz Chayes. Why do we know that? Because the Maritz Chayes was delighted that the Chasam Sofer wrote back to him, and he published a shuva in his own sefer. So the question was, I was asked, unfortunately I don't have the text of the rest of the tshuva, but I have the summary of it. I was asked by a Kohen physician who was requested, as per the law of the country, to examine a patient who was pronounced dead to confirm the diagnosis prior to burial. So you have a Kohen who was asked, so in order, those 3 days that the person was kept above ground, a physician had to go in and confirm death. You have to go in day one, day two, day three. So he was asked whether a Kohen is allowed to go in because the person is most likely dead. Now there's again, and I apologize for these brief tangents, but just to give an appreciation of the complexity of halacha, there's a shaila whether Kohen can become a physician at all today, because a Kohanim physicians get exposed to Tumas Mace in anatomy lab, anatomical dissection, and there are ways for Kohanim to do it with many people receive a psak for it, and it's not everybody's a fan of it. But it is done today. I had a Kohen in my medical school class whose posek held like that shita that we mentioned by Eliyahu. It says by Yismodet ala Yeled that Akum is not Metame Tumas Ohel. So he was in the anatomy lab. He didn't even touch the corpse, but he was in the room, and other people like myself would do the manipulations for him during our exams. And he would just write down the answer, you know, he would say point to the left, point to the right, and, you know, dissect a little here, dissect a little there. And he graduated medical, so he ended up becoming an ophthalmologist, which is less exposure to pikuach nefesh issues. You know, for Cohen to be a pathologist is a serious issue. Although there are shilas about a Cohen being a tissue pathologist, not someone who actually does full autopsies, but someone who just gets tissue samples from the operating room, or just looks at tissue samples, that are many of them are less than a kazais. So there's a shailus about a kohen being a pathologist. So the shailatim was whether a kohen can go in. So he used this as an opportunity, which we'll discuss towards the end, to discuss his take on the halachic definition of death up until his time, and whether the existing halachic definition of death up until 1700s, 1800s should be altered based on what the contemporary medical community now says. So let's move into the 20th and 21st century, where pretty much until this period of time. So we had that brief chapter. By the way, that chapter ultimately dissipated because they found that, in fact, after scientific review, that people really weren't buried alive. The reports of scratch marks inside the graves, notwithstanding. But they found that that after all these studies and all these decades of believing that people were actually buried alive, that it didn't really pan out. So this fear sort of gradually dissipated after a few decades of time. So in essence, until the late 20th century, death was really only defined in one way: when the heart stopped, and obviously whenever the heart stopped, breathing would stop again very shortly thereafter. When did this change? This changed in 1968. Why did this change? This changed for the following reason. Prior to the mid-20th century, if somebody sustained, Rahman al-Islam, a heart attack, and the heart stopped beating, you would have no blood flow to the brain. And if you have no blood flow to the brain stops functioning. One of the functions of the brain is to breathe. You would stop breathing within just a few moments' time. And the converse was also true. If you sustained a major brain injury, be it a spontaneous brain injury like a spontaneous hemorrhage or a major trauma to the brain which causes bleeding and swelling of the brain would stop telling your body to breathe. No oxygen would go to the heart, and the heart would soon stop thereafter. So cardiac and neurological or brain death invariably happened within a few moments of each other until the mid-20th century. What changed that? One device is responsible for changing that, and that is the respirator or the life support system or the ventilator, whichever synonym you want to use. We now have a device which goes directly into the lungs. We put a plastic tube into the lungs, connect that tube to a machine, deliver oxygen to the body, and create for the first time in history a dissociation between the death of the brain and the death of the heart. What's the classic scenario? Classic scenario is, Rahman al-Islam, someone has a major accident, a motorcyclist has a major head trauma, sustains massive trauma to the brain. The brain starts to swell from all the trauma. The brain basically stops to function. But EMS gets to the scene within 2 minutes of the event, immediately puts the person on a respirator, and starts to deliver oxygen artificially through the blood supply so that the heart now receives oxygen. As long as the heart receives oxygen, the heart can continue to beat irrespective of the function of the brain. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the heart as an independent system. It has its independent electrical system. And as long as you provide the heart with oxygen, it can continue to beat. They even noticed this thousands of years ago. Physicians and scientists would remove hearts, not usually from human beings, but usually from animals, and place the heart on a table. And they'd put the heart on the table, and they'd see that the heart would continue to beat for a relative period of time, even though you removed it from the body. So it is. It has. It's obviously not completely autonomous and self-sufficient. It is interconnected to the body, but in this particular scenario, it's possible for the heart to continue to beat. Yes.
Just to clarify, the ventilator or respirator sends air into the lungs.
Correct.
The lungs then diffuse the oxygen to the blood flow.
Correct.
And through the blood flow.
Through the blood flow, it goes to the heart.
The heart, and the heart keeps on getting those.
Correct. That is absolutely correct. So once this device became very popular in the practice of medicine, what happened was the following. They now had all these patients who were on a respirator who basically had no brain function and didn't seem to be waking up, but their hearts were still beating. So the question was, what do we do with these patients? Do we keep them in the intensive care unit? Yes.
What happens to other organs and body, though? going?
Good question. So those can keep going for a period of time. And what's interesting is that in a diagnosis of brain death, in the usual case of a diagnosis of brain death, and we'll see that there clearly are exceptions, once the brain stops functioning, even if a person is on a respirator, the heart will stop functioning within a few days period of time. Exactly how many days, there's no definitive answer. But the other things that the brain regulates, for example, may start to malfunction, like temperature of the body might start to malfunction. Other things might start to malfunction. Now, you would think in theory that if you're delivering oxygen to the heart and the rest of the body is healthy, it maybe could last for decades like this. But that's not usually the case. Usually, and scientists don't fully understand why, usually when brain death is declared, cardiac cessation ensues within a few days. But there are cases, as we'll see, where that's not true, where people can have a diagnosis of brain death and still have a heartbeat for days, weeks, months, even a year or more afterwards.
But you're not going to have cessation of kidney function, liver function.
So you could have the preservation. Well, once the heart stops, you'll have cessation of all these things. If there's no intrinsic lung problem, then the lungs can function, the heart can function, the kidneys can function, the liver can function, as long as there's blood flow to these organs. Basically, and we'll see the term that's been coined, the blood flow stops above the neck, but there is still blood flow to the rest of the body. But the brain and the connection of the brain, which is the command center, the stops. So a committee from Harvard in the late 1960s got together and made this diagnosis a definition of irreversible coma based on what they observed in these patients who had this massive brain damage, whose hearts were still beating, and we don't need to discuss the medical criteria, but they established a few medical criteria, and this became known as brain death. And this became accepted ultimately as an alternate definition to death, that you could die by cardiorespiratory death with your heart stopping, or you could die by brain death. Now, why was this so important in the practice of medicine? There's two real major areas for which it was absolutely essential. Area number one was, from the perspective of the medical community, wasteful or futile treatment. So to keep someone on a respirator whose brain is dead and will not regain function was a waste of an intensive care unit when you can have a bed in the intensive care unit to treat somebody who could potentially survive. And it was also a savings of expense. It costs thousands of dollars a day to have a patient in the intensive care unit. Why should this patient be there when there's no chance of recovery? And number two, which is perhaps equivalent, maybe even more important from the advances in medicine, is that now what you have created is a potential organ donor which didn't really exist before. And let me explain why that is and why that's so essential in this whole landscape and this whole debate. Until the diagnosis of brain death, the only people who ever served as organ donors were people who sustained cardiac death. Once someone sustains cardiac death and there is no blood flow to the organs start to decompose. Once the organs start to decompose, literally the clock starts ticking once the heart stops beating in terms of the viability of an organ for transplant. The longer you wait, the less likely this organ is going to be usable to transplant into another human being. So it was very, very difficult to get organs from a patient who had died. But now with this new alternate definition of death, the following could occur. You have someone who's on a respirator in an intensive care unit, has a blood pressure, has a pulse, has blood flowing through all the organs, and the classic donor, if you will, was the motorcycle accident, who just had head trauma, young guy, otherwise healthy, all his organs are completely healthy. You could then legally diagnose this person as being dead, send in the surgical team, and harvest all the major organs to transplant into somebody who needed a transplant. So this definition, not single-handedly, but in combination with other advances like immunosuppression and things like that, is responsible for the tremendous boom in the whole field of transplantation over the last half century. Is that clear? Because that's a very important aspect of this whole of this whole debate. And just to whip through this without belaboring, but I'll send you the slide so you have it just for references. That definition was back in the 1960s. It was revisited 40, 50 years later in the neurological literature. This is from JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, 2009. Coma is a clinical state, has ancient roots, but the identification and precise codification of specific neurological criteria for brain death, causal of irreversible coma, was first published in the now classic article in 1968. The criteria for brain death enumerated in this article have surely held up during the past 40 years. So the criteria that were established, those neurological criteria, have been revisited, analyzed in the medical literature decade after decade after decade, and they pretty much remain constant. And here's another article from 2010, evidence-based guideline update determining brain death in adults. And here's some of the medical aspects. There are two major ways to diagnose brain death. One is through clinical exam, and these are just some of the clinical criteria that you would use. Testing for the presence of different reflexes. Of course, you don't need to know this. This one you need to know because you'll find in the halachic literature, you may see it referenced in the halachic literature. One of the hallmarks of the definition of brain death, and this is absolutely essential for our discussion, is the absence of respiration. There is absolutely no breathing of this patient, because when the brain stops functioning, when we say brain death, we mean with the brain stem function missing, not just the cortex of the brain, which is the top of the brain, but with the brain stem, which is the responsible for vegetative functions. That's why, by the way, we'll talk about Terry Schiavo in a minute. I don't know if you've ever heard the term vegetable, or someone who's in a coma or a persistent vegetative state. So the reason the term vegetable has evolved is not because of associations that you might think. It's because they have persistent vegetative functions. The vegetative functions are the basic core functions, which include breathing and temperature and things like that. So these are people who lose the function of the top of their brain. So they're no longer conscious, because that's responsible for consciousness. But they have spontaneous breathing and things like that. In brain death, by definition, it's cessation of all brain function, the cortex of the brain and the brain stem, and no spontaneous breathing. We'll see this is very halachically important. So this test can actually be performed to see if indeed there is spontaneous breathing or not. The other aspects include imaging studies. And there are many different types of imaging studies. You don't need to be a radiologist to appreciate the difference between these two studies. This is looking at the skull from the side, as if I was standing here. So this would be the normal blood flow, the carotid blood vessels tracking up through the brain. In the brain death situation, everything stops at the base of the brain. The reason that is because the brain swells. And since the skull is hard bone, the brain starts to swell. There's nowhere for the brain to go. It expands and compresses all the blood vessels. Once it compresses the blood vessels, there's no brain for blood flow to the brain. Once you have no blood flow to the brain, you have no brain function. Yes? So sometimes the swelling can be irreversible. But usually once you're at this point, so we see patients all the time in the ER who have increased intracranial pressure. And we will give medications or do maneuvers or alter blood pressure to try and decrease that intracranial pressure. But once your intracranial pressure is high enough that you stop the blood flow, it's not as if you could lower the pressure and the blood flow will start back again. So this really is a point pretty much of irreversibility. This one also, I know it's a little difficult to see the difference. This is normal. This is brain death. An important thing to appreciate is that the neurological association set criteria for the definition of death. What is interesting, not necessarily a good thing, is that not all hospitals, not all states have the exact same criteria. There is no legal requirement for all of them to have the same exact criteria. So it's not uniformly defined between institutions. The reason I mention this is because if ultimately you are involved in a case, you need to make sure that all the criteria are being done properly and not rely on the physicians necessarily in every case. Here I mentioned the difference between coma and brain death. So I don't know, do you guys remember Terry Schiavo? Anybody remember that name?
Yeah.
So she was in a persistent vegetative state, and there was a debate about pulling her feeding tube. Many people thought erroneously that she was brain dead. She was not brain dead. She was not connected to a respirator. She was breathing on her own. She had a respiratory arrest, probably from an early illness as a child, and had anoxic encephalopathy, so which means that she lost oxygen to the brain, but she was not brain dead. You need to distinguish.
Is that the Supreme Court decision?
Well, I don't remember who it ultimately ended up being. It was the governor at that time, was Governor Jeb Bush in Florida, going back with the courts, and I don't know if the Supreme Court ultimately got involved with that. I don't remember the specifics. Ultimately, they did pull the tube. By the way, this tombstone was written by her husband. There was machlokas between the husband and the parents. So the husband said, she's dead, let's stop feeding her. Parents said, she's alive, and they showed videos of the movement and all these kinds of things. That's still leave that for discussion of end-of-life issues. But he wrote her tombstone, Shivo Teresa Marie, beloved wife, born December 3rd, departed this earth February 25th, 1990. That's when she had her cardiac arrest. And that's when she sustained the damage. At peace, March 31st, 2005, that's when they pulled the tube, and that's when she sustained cardiac death, and that's when she was diagnosed to be dead. Now, there are things which mimic the definition of death, mimic death. And this is one of my favorite cartoons. This is a bear at a bear funeral. It says, for crying out loud, I was hibernating. Don't you guys ever check a pulse? So there are things which can mimic death, like hibernation. And you don't need to know them, but just know that they exist. Locked-in syndrome, hypothermia is low temperature. Drug intoxications can mimic death. We in the ER, we see hypothermia often. We see drug intoxication often. We have to make sure that we're not misdiagnosing somebody as being dead if they have these kinds of criteria. And there's a whole host of situations where you will read every year that someone is misdiagnosed as being dead. You know, Tel Aviv woman returns from the dead, dead Vietnamese man revived, toddler revived after believed dead, child pronounced dead, etc., etc. So what do you do with all these cases? Do these impact our discussion here? Oklahoma City, man declared brain dead. Wakes up after hearing doctors say he is dead. 2008. Patient awoke to doctors mistakenly preparing to remove her organs. Right? This is not from the Star or the Inquirer. This is a real report. So what is the... and here, I don't know if you heard of the Jahi McMath case. This was a young girl who... how old is she at the time? I think 13, 14 years old. She had sleep apnea, which means she had difficulty with her sleep, and they thought it was related to the anatomy of her throat. So they did a surgery on her throat. They hit a blood vessel and couldn't stop the bleeding of the blood vessel intraoperatively. And she had a cardiac arrest and was deprived of oxygen for a fairly long period of time, unfortunately, tragically. And the doctors diagnosed her as having brain death. The family refused to accept that definition, and they went to court over this definition. And they said she's dead, and they were getting ready to declare her dead. The family transported her out of California, and the child is now in New Jersey, who's still alive, still has a heartbeat, and this is a year and a half, 2 years later, I think. Still has a heartbeat, and there's a debate whether she still carries a diagnosis of being brain dead or not. So these are very interesting discussions about the validity of brain death. Now let me just clarify how death works. Death, by definition, is an irreversible process. So if these people are coming back, then obviously they were never diagnosed as being dead. Not for our discussion today, but they're interesting halachic shilas about someone who these shilas began when CPR was first initiated. The poskim were left with the following kinds of shilas. Let's say someone flatlines and the doctors bring him back, and a kohen walks into the room. Is a kohen metame during the time that the guy is flatlined? Does the person have to remarry his wife? Because was he considered a mace during this time? And then his wife becomes mutter l'shuk, you know, so does he have to remarry his wife after these kinds of things? So, I mean, the answer which they gave, and we now know in retrospect, obviously, that death by definition is irreversible. So if they came back, it's a gilui das that they were never dead. You can't say they were dead and became alive. If they did, then the doctor would be Mechaim Mason. We're not Mechaim Mason. But death by definition is irreversible. Now, given all these cases, the medical literature, none of these cases were diagnosed neurologically according to the strict, rigid criteria. And in this article, this is from 2010, now to be honest, we could update this, and there may indeed be new cases since 2010. But they found that no reports whatsoever, zero, in peer-reviewed medical journals of recovery of brain function after determination of brain death using the American Association of Neurology's criteria. Yes?
That just means that technically they didn't find anything changed. That doesn't mean that's what that's defined by it.
No, this doesn't impact, it may impact the halacha, even though those who accept the brain death criteria, because maybe it could cast a suffix on the criteria if people are indeed waking up. But the point is that in the discussion of what constitutes brain death by definition is an irreversible process. All those cases where people, quote, came back, they did extensive research into those cases, they weren't properly diagnosed to begin with. Now, obviously, a whole separate discussion. Doctors make mistakes. There is no question about that. Doctors are human beings. No question about that. But we're talking about those who adhere to the strict criteria. There is no... Now, we'll see in a moment, does the fact that they don't wake up, does that impact their halachic status? We'll see. Because these patients that don't wake up and never return to consciousness, their hearts are still beating until the heart stops. So that obviously has halachic relevance in our halachic discussion. By the way, there is a discussion in the very recent halachic literature, just within the last year or two, based on irreversibility. Not ignoring the whole halachic debate about whether brain death is death or not death, about whether someone who is mispalel for the refuah shlema for somebody who's brain dead is engaging in a tefilas shav. Because from a physiological perspective, it is impossible for this person to recover. There are no recorded cases in the medical literature of someone who is brain dead, who is properly diagnosed as being brain dead, who returns to a state of consciousness, who returns as any substantive recovery. So there's a back and forth in halachic literature, just an FYI. So we're going to spend the last part of our discussion about what the halachic sources are that discuss this and what the contemporary halachic debate is about this issue. I will tell you that in the history of halacha, this is one of the most contentious topics in the world of halacha. It's been debated for the last few decades. There have been sort of ups and downs and some new information here, new information there. It remains a very hotly contested, very debated topic. I remember when I was your age, our edutainment was to go watch Rabbi Bleich and Rabbi Tendler debate the brain death issue. That was like, you know, immense fun to see these two extraordinary minds going at each other debating this. And this, or different people, you know, sometimes it was other people debating the topic, but this was like, the big boxing match of the generation was watching the debate about brain death in those ages. And to be honest, it hasn't changed so much. It's obviously not many things have surfaced since then. But it remains a very complex debate, and our objective is not to take a side in any way, shape, or form. It's really to share with you what the halachic sources are and give you an opportunity to do further study if you so wish. In essence, there are four major sources which are involved in this brain death debate, and it also makes it one of the most fascinating from a pure halachic perspective that there's so few sources, yet the opinions are so divergent one from another, literally diametrically opposed in their interpretation of just a handful of sources. And that's what makes it such a fascinating halachic study. So one of the classic sources is the Gemara in Yoma. And for any of these, there is myriads of articles written about each one of these, and I'm happy to reference for those of you who want to do additional study to share with you. The first classic source is the context of the Gemara Yoma about Chilul Shabbos, and it's the Mishnah Nafal of Mapolis. If someone has a collapsed building, Rachmanot Tzlan, and it happens on a Shabbos, you have a heter, obviously, for Pikuach Nefesh to try and remove the rubble from the individual, but your heter only lasts as long as you can determine whether the person's alive or dead. Once you determine the death of the patient, your license to violate Shabbos no longer exists. So the Gemara has to give you a practical way to tell you when you can stop removing the rubble. So Tana Rabbanan ad heichanu bodek, how far do you check? So one man de Amar says ad chotmo, you check until the nostrils, and the other man de Amar says ad libo. The Yeshomrim ad libo. By the way, the Yerushalmi and others have a different gear, so ad taburo. Taburo is the umbilicus, the belly button. There's a reason why these girsas are different. So the Gemara goes back and forth. The Gemara debates whether the person was discovered head first or discovered foot first. So if discovered foot first, you're going to reach the heart first. If discovered head first, you're going to reach the nostrils first. So Rav Papa says, Machlokas, this is the maskana of the Gemara, Machlokas mimata lamala. The machlokas is only if you reach the body foot first, aval mimala lamata, but everyone agrees, if you reach the body head first, kevan debodak le'ad chotmo, once you reach the nostrils, shuv eino tzarich, you can stop, and assuming that you put the mirror there, the feather there, and there's no respiration, then you can stop, dikziv kol asher nishmas ruach chayim be'apov. And it quotes the pasuk from Bereshis, that the life is associated with the neshama, and the ruach are associated with the presence of life. We could spend easily hours discussing this, the details of the sugya. Just want to highlight a couple of the major approaches and the major points. One major issue is, since they're mentioning a pasuk, d'chsiv kol asher nishmas ruach chayim be'apov, does that mean it's now taken out of the hands of physicians how death is defined, and now becomes a mesorah based on a pasuk? And it's has nothing to do with what the doctors say. That's one dimension of it, which is a tier. The other dimension of it is that the Gemara seems to conclude that everything is determined by the af, by the nose. Now here's what I mentioned, that everyone's dealing with the same sources, but the interpretations can be literally diametrically opposed. So those who maintain that even though it says you determine based on the nose, that the respirations, and this is a key point, is not the definition of death, it's a sign that death has occurred. Now what do I mean by that? It's a very important distinction. So we'll talk about Rabbi Bleich's sheet in a moment, but I'll mention it here. So Rabbi Bleich would interpret this in the following fashion, that when you're checking the nostrils and when you're checking respiration, you are only checking it in as much as it is a reflection of cardiac activity. And if there's no breathing, it's telling you that there is no heart activity, because after all, everything we are concerned about is the heart. Heart 1, heart 2, heart 3. That's all we're concerned about. Breathing just tells us that the heart is functioning. The others would say that no, respiration is the primary determinant, the definition of life. And if a person has no respiration, then they have no life. Now today, what is the ultimate physiological way to determine that there is no independent respiration? If the brain has stopped functioning, and you test the brain function, and there is no function of the brain, and there's no independent respiration, this would confirm that there is no definition, that there is no spontaneous respiration, and would therefore be like a chumrah on the Gemara, and would therefore confirm that this person is in fact dead, according to those who define breathing as the criterion. Yes?
But like your Schechter brought to me once, by that definition you would call somebody who's clearly alive but on a ventilator.
Right, that is why irreversible cessation of brain death, untreatable cessation of brain death is what is required. So there are many people, I see people all the time, have neurological conditions that can't expand their chest wall. You know, they're you give them oxygen, they're conscious, they're alive, they're alert. It's in the context of somebody who is basically dead and has no independent respirations. And you will find me all these cases, and they exist in a chanami. We can talk about each one individually. And there's an answer response to each one, yes.
Sorry, how does it come out of the Gemara, this debate? I think you referenced this, like whether it's just a sign or whether it's the definition of
it's God. Really just an interpretation of the Gemara. So it's how you interpret Kevin de Bodak Le Ad Chotmo, and how you interpret that the Kol Asher Nishmas Ruach Chayim Be'apov. Those who say so the Gemara says objectively you check the nostrils, you check the nares. The question is, what does that mean?
and the pasuk would suggest that it's together, not just.
It would suggest that. Now I'm going to share with you a few. For those who are interested, I'm not going to discuss this now. I actually looked at this Rashi. Rashi says, "Belibo yesh lahavchin in yesh bochius." Shenishma so dofekes sham. Umar amar ad chotmo, de zimnin de ein chios nikar belibo, ve nikar bechotmo. Now, most people would interpret this, nishma so dofekes sham. So you check the heart. Why are you checking the heart to see if there's life? Shenishma so dofekes sham. So how would you interpret that? That's where the soul is. That's where the soul of a human being is. So my interpretation of this, and this is, again, this is just take it or leave it. But putting this into a historical context, we talked about the innate heat. According to those in the times of Rashi, they believed that when the air went into the mouth, the air was like the bellows fanning the flames of the innate heat of the heart. They believed that the air went directly into the heart from the mouth and fed the flames of the heart. So the Pashas Rashi, based on that interpretation, again, take it or leave it, is shenishma so dofekes sham, is his breathing is transmitted into the heart. The air is transmitted into the heart. And that's what he means by nishma so dofekes sham, and not for now, but I think there is potential nafkamina in the way to interpret that Gemara based on that interpretation. But the poskim, the Rambam, those who, for example, and again, I'm going to sort of go through these sources and show you how different people would interpret the different sources. Those who maintain that respiration is the absolute determinant focus on the halacha psuka of the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, which mentions exclusively, as the Gemara's conclusion is, Badku ad chotmo v'lo matzu bo neshama meinichin oso shom shekvar meis. So the Rambam and then the Shulchan Aruch pretty much follows. All they mention is respiration. There's no mention whatsoever of cardiac activity. Yes? So before the respirator, if someone wasn't breathing, they would eventually die. Absolutely.
The Rambam is saying that it depends on his breathing. Even then was the reality. Even if you would start to breathe, that would be the reality.
So that's an excellent point. In the pre-modern era, if a person wasn't breathing, he definitely would die. If the person's heart stopped beating, he definitely would die. The question is, sometimes, for example, you have someone who's large-chested. You may not feel a pulse, but he could have a heartbeat and he could be breathing. So that's why you have to check the respiration. Sometimes it's called a false positive. You might think that the person's dead, but there are other signs that the person is alive. So in the historical context, you have to make sure, and they did make mistakes. There were times where they thought people were dead, and in fact they just passed out, or they were comatose, or they had problems which could potentially get better. Correct. I mean, that seems to be the pashas of the Rambam. The Rambam doesn't mention anything about heart. The Shulchan Aruch doesn't mention anything about heart.
I mean, that wouldn't necessarily shed light when today we can keep someone alive.
Correct. So that is a huge issue. The question is not to take modern science and interpolate it back into the Rambam, interpolate it back into the Shulchan Aruch. The question that you always have to ask is, if the Rambam were alive today, if the Mechaber were alive today, how would they paskin based on the contemporary medical information? That's really the question you're always going to have to ask. So that was source number one, which has a lot of discussion about it. Source number two is the Mishnah in Olos. Mishnah in Olos is talking about when someone is dead. And the Mishnah says, Adam eino matame ad shetetze nafsho. A person doesn't die until the soul leaves the body. How do you know when the soul leaves the body? So we have to obviously apply clinical criteria to that. We don't have a neshama meter at the bedside that I can tell you somebody's died or not. But the Mishnah says, af hutzu roshehen, confused over here, hutzu roshehen, af al pishim mefarkasim, tamein, kigon zonov shalutah, shehim mefarkasis. Now, Rabbi Tendler is one of those who supports the brain death criteria, and he looks at this mission as one of the primary supports. And he says, Hutsu Roshayan, if someone is decapitated, physically decapitated, and they are still moving, like Zanam Haltos, if you chop off the lizard's tail, you know, it'll still move for a little while. And even, by the way, it's called the Lazarus effect. There are these remarkable cases recorded in the French history of these people who underwent the guillotine and said, after the guillotine, after my head's chopped off, I'm going to stand up and walk across the stage. And apparently, kachava. So that's Mifarcheses. Everyone agrees that these people are halachically dead, and they are metane. If a kohen is there at the time that the head's chopped off, even if the body walks across the stage, when as soon as the head's chopped off, the person's amazed, the person's metame. So the extension in this scenario is that the definition, the death of the brain, and we showed the physiological absence of blood flow above the neck, so that the term which Rabbi Tendler coined is physiological decapitation. That this individual who is brain dead, his head is still physically connected to his body, but there is a physiological decapitation. There is no longer a connection to the rest of the body. Now, there's a major debate, which I'll just mention briefly, and it requires much more discussion, that there are those who claim that perhaps it's not really true, that when a person is diagnosed as being brain dead today, there still is some connection between the brain. There still is some neurological function, albeit very minimal function, and maybe not major function, but there seems to be some kind of messages getting through from the brain, and maybe that's an impact on the shita. So the and I'll get to your question in a second, Kalman. So the counter argument to that is that in a chanami, that could be true, but it's the death of the command functions of the brain and the cessation of independent respiration, which is all that's essential for this particular criterion, not that every single function of the brain be completely stopped. And we'll see that Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach Zatzal had a different shita about this. Yes? Temperature control is one of those things. Blood pressure control, one of those things. Some are combined. Temperature control seems to be hypothalamic. So that's one of those things which seems to be getting through. And that debate is sort of surfaced in the literature. Other things just to mention, which you will encounter, is the chew of the Chacham Tzvi. Chacham Tzvi, living in the 1600s, was asked the Shaila, if a chicken is found without a heart, is the chicken kosher or not? And he used this as an excuse to launch into the significance of the heart from a halachic perspective. It sparked a whole debate, which went on for centuries, about this particular psak, but it was resuscitated, if you will, in the 20th century for those discussing the importance of heartbeat. And basically, the Chacham Tzvi gives tremendous primacy to the heart. He says that the heart really is the both from a Kabbalistic perspective, from a halacha perspective, is like the main organ. And those who require the cessation of heartbeat specifically, in addition to other makoros, turn to the Chacham Tzvi as a primary source for the primacy of the primacy of the heart. By the way, the Chacham Tzvi was writing after the discovery of the circulation of the blood, but he wasn't yet aware of William Harvey's discovery of the circulation of the blood, and that's an interesting debate about had he known about the circulation of the blood, if or how that could have impacted in any way, shape, or form. The other tshuva, which is oft quoted and debated and discussed in different ways from the different poskim, is the tshuva of the Chasam Sofer that we mentioned before. Chasam Sofer, when asked that question about the Kohen, paskined in the following way. He said, we Jews have been defining death for thousands of years. We've been burying on criteria that the Chevra Kadisha has always been using. We do not plan on changing anything we've been doing because these scientists believe that the person might actually still be alive. And he wrote the following, which is also interestingly interpreted in diametrically opposed ways by the different shitas. So in one place he writes, once the breathing stopped, we are no longer mechalal Shabbos. Etc. And here it seems to be that he's focusing on the respiration, that the respiration is the criterion, and those who want to accept the brain death criteria will turn to this and say that this is the determinant, the respiration is the determinant. But others, well, the counter argument is about kol sha'achar shemutol ke'even dome, that what is the clinical context that the Chasam Sofer is talking about? Shemutol ke'even dome, that the person is completely still like a rock, the ein bo shum defika, and he has no heartbeat, the macharkach botol hanishima, eino eladivetar seino hakadosha. So it seems to be that he's explicitly saying that there's a requirement that there be a cessation of heartbeat in addition to cessation of respirations. And we can go into a back and forth about this, but again, it's interpreted differently. More has been written on the definition of death than any other topic in the world of medical halacha by far. These are all books entirely devoted to the topic. I have personally attended probably 10 days, full-day conferences just on the topic of the definition of death in the last, 5 to 10 years or so, including the Shita of Rav Moshe, including the Rabbi Blythe's Shita, including, this is a relative of Shlomo Zalman. This is a very, very brief, in the interest of time, very, very cursory conclusion of how the breakdown of the poskim is in terms of all the foregoing and these different sugyas and the different approaches. The bottom line is there is absolutely no consensus. There are major poskim on both sides of the coin, major poskim who clearly reject the brain death criteria, both out of definitional reasons and their interpretation of the sugya, and simply out of suffolk that it's an issue of pikuach nefesh. And if we don't have clear definitive evidence that brain death is halachic death, we simply cannot say that it's halachic death because of the consequences of Ritzicha involved. So basically you have Rav Moshe and Rabbi Tendler, and Rabbi Tendler was heavily involved with Rav Moshe in that period of discussion of the definition of death. And here also, I apologize for shortchanging you, but Rav Moshe has a number of tshuvas on this topic. Just to clarify, I am putting Rav Moshe and Rabbi Tendler as clearly down on the side of the definition of death as halachic death, but there is a major, major debate whether in fact Rav Moshe himself accepted the brain death criteria or not. It is not unequivocal on a very close reading of his tshuvas. There are many ambiguities, there are many ways to interpret the tshuvas in different ways. It is not as if Rav Moshe says very explicitly, very clearly, I 100% accept the brain death criteria, I 100% will allow somebody to serve as an organ donor if they are defined as brain death. So that remains somewhat of a question mark. There are those who have spent literally dissertations and years analyzing the tshuvas of Rav Moshe, collecting evidence from people who have testified that they spoke with Rav Moshe and Rav Moshe clearly accepted the brain death criteria. That's not really so much for our discussion here. For those interested, again, I'm happy to share that information with you. Chief Rabbinate of Israel, back in the 70s and 80s, and reaffirmed again in 2008, officially accepted the brain death criteria. I'm skipping Rav Schechter Shlita for a moment. Rabbi Blythe Shlita and Rabbi Yoshev Zatzal and Rabbi Waldenberg Zatzal come down on the side of rejection of the brain death criteria. They're absolutely against the acceptance of the brain death criteria. Rav Schechter Shita is a very different Shita than everybody else. He has an entirely different Mahalach than everything we've discussed until now. And his Mahalach is based on let's see if I can just pull it up quickly for you. His Mahalach is based on the fact that circulation is the determinant, and based on the Sugis of the Gemara, that there are three Eivarim, Shehaneshama Teluya Bohem. Three organs which are connected to the definition of life: the heart, the liver, and the brain. And based on that, he has Shaka Vitaria about whether you need just one of these to be absent in order to define death, or whether you need all of them absent to define death. And I'll share with you Rav Orbach's Shita, and with this we'll close. Rav Orbach had a unique Shita amongst the poskim also. he accepted the concept of hutzu roshehem, that that in principle, if there was complete physiological decapitation, in fact, one could define the person as being halachically dead. However, as opposed to others, he required that there be complete disintegration of the entire tissue of the brain in order for one to define brain death as halachic death and for it to be considered hutzu roshehem. So that usually is not the case in the initial stages of brain death. It does ultimately ensue, you know, weeks later there is a lysis of the tissue of the brain. And perhaps for another time, there was a question about his shita, which led to this famous experiment of the decapitated sheep. Anybody familiar with the decapitated sheep experiment? So in the interest of time, I don't have time to discuss that, but perhaps another time. It's really a fascinating discussion, why it was performed, how it was performed, and how it affected the shita of Shlomo Zalman. So in conclusion, we've had an opportunity to discuss the definition of death in Tanakh, in some of the halachic literature, the antecedent to this contemporary discussion back in the 17 and 1800s, where the poskim dealt with the issue of the definition of death, and now in the 21st century, the reiteration of that major debate about what constitutes the definition of death. There is no unanimity amongst the poskim. There are major halachic ramifications, including whether someone can give or receive a transplant, whether you can disconnect someone who's brain dead, whether a kohen is metame, etc., etc. All those things you will realize in the course of time as you get exposed to these in a more practical sense. So any shkayach to you gentlemen, if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer any questions.